Welcome back to the Educated Patient Podcast. I am your host, Mike DeMarco, and today we are joined by Dr. Prabhakian. He's an internationally recognized leader in vascular neurology. February is Heart Health Month, and so I'm excited for today's conversation. I will let Dr. Prabhakian introduce himself and set the stage for today's conversation. So welcome, doctor.
Thank you, Mike. So I'm Dr. Prabhakaran. I'm a vascular neurologist or stroke specialist. I'm here at the University of Chicago, where I'm the chair of a department of neurology, which is the space that vascular neurologists or stroke neurologists live in. And I live in Chicago. I've been here now my 20th year in Chicago. You know, raise a family here and think about some of the questions that you're going to ask on a daily basis because it comes up in our house.
As we were preparing for the episode, one thing that immediately resonated from us just getting to know each other was how much you valued this type of dialogue from doctors to patients. And I'm curious to unpack that a little bit for the listeners here on, from your lens as the expert. Why is this type of conversation, not just for strokes or, you know, vascular or Heart Health Month important, but in any of these conditions important?
Well, I would say that's a great question. And I would say that, you know, the dialogue between health experts, healthcare professionals, and the population at large and patients specifically, I think has been strained recently, and we have not always hit the target in terms of how to make simple points about complex issues and also, you know, drive home messages around what actions really are important and what's the basis for those recommendations. And I think, you know, there's a lot of written editorials about this in recent years around what happened post-COVID and how trust in healthcare eroded. And I think these types of dialogues are the best way for the medical profession to reestablish that trust and regain it.
Mm. Jumping right into heart health, specifically with the way you practice medicine, Can you immediately just touch on the connection between heart health and brain health and how those are tied together?
Yes. So, you know, about 20 to 25% of blood flow goes to the brain from the heart. So the heart pumps blood, and blood contains oxygen and sugar and nutrients. And a big chunk of it has to go to your brain to function. And so the relationship between the heart and the brain starts right there. It's dependent on the heart functioning. It's dependent on blood flow. And as a result, we think of problems in the heart as causing problems in the brain. That's really the first point that we often want to make, is that heart problems can cause brain problems, namely stroke, but also conditions like dementia. Or cognitive impairment. And the opposite direction is also true. We know that because the brain is the computer center of your entire body, the nervous system, nerves and wiring, the wiring from the computers in your head actually go into organs like the heart and control rhythms of the heart. And there are certain types of arrhythmias that we see sometimes post-stroke because the brain was damaged. And there's also a lot of common things that you know happen every day. When you get excited and anxious, guess what happens to your heart rate? It goes up. That's a direct connection from your brain to your heart. And so the fluidity and the bidirectional relationship between the heart and brain has always been there. I think we're really keen on sort of thinking them about them together.
Mm. Why stroke medicine? What point of your schooling were you sure that this was the direction that you wanted to go?
Oh, that's a great question. I was very attracted to the possibility of of doing things to help patients who are experiencing one of the worst things you can experience, which is a stroke. You're losing your identity. You're losing functions, quality of life. It's a really dramatic thing to have a stroke. You suddenly are no longer yourself. And I started my career in an era when there was the promise and the emergence of treatments that were really trying to restore blood flow to the brain. That's what a stroke is. A stroke is when blood flow is blocked or disturbed to the brain. And we're starting to see the first treatments 20, 25 years ago. And now, I mean, I can't tell you just how proud I am of the field, because many, many treatments have been developed in 20, 25 years that actually do reverse the problem that starts a stroke, which is a blood flow problem, and can do it in such a manner that the tissue, the brain cells, don't die and actually come back to function. And that is a really amazing thing to see someone who would have been either disabled or even dead return back to normal function.
Yeah, I've had a few family members and friends of family that have experienced stroke. I'm sure most people listening to this know at least one person within one degree of separation from them that's experienced this. And it's amazing to see how the recovery process has changed over the past, let's call it 20 years. I had an elderly family member in their 80s who had a stroke within the last 6 years. And they went from, we didn't even know if they were going to be able to talk again, to playing golf. I played golf with them last summer, right? And I think 20 years ago, that was kind of written off as, unfortunately, this is just the way it is. We'll still do the therapy and work in this direction, but we're only going to be able to get so far. And it's been like, again, just listening to you and thinking that's an elderly person is still able to recover and go from nonverbal to playing golf, which is insane.
Absolutely. All that's possible now. And I think the future of stroke medicine is also very bright. Now, not only can we restore blood flow quickly, and there are all sorts of ways to do that, there's also great ways to restore function. And that's in part through rehabilitation, which you mentioned, and the emergence of technology that I think we didn't have 20 years ago. And those are going to be really key to the future of stroke, is how do we incorporate these technologies directly to help patients improve functions. And they could be speech-related technologies. They could be movement-related technologies. And you're going to see an explosion of that in the decade ahead.
What's a common misconception that you come across regularly that people misunderstand around stroke risk or maybe even the connection to the heart?
Yeah, well, I think one misconception, which I think is really important for the audience, is that, well, it comes out of the blue. And it's just a sudden without warning event. And that is true that to some degree, strokes are defined by that it's a sudden change in blood flow that causes neurologic symptoms. But in reality, the risk of that event actually accrues and is in the background occurring over the course of decades often. And that could be in the form of risk factors that are treatable and if managed better, like high blood pressure or AFib, which we're going to talk about, I think, you could have prevented that event from happening, right? So that's the message, the misconception that I think people should correct, is that it's very much a preventable condition, even though it can be a sudden dramatic event. One can do a lot of things in the years ahead of that to have prevented it in the first place.
There are, at least in the last 2 years, there's been an explosion of I'm going to call them consumer-facing vendors for all of these data points. I mean, there's at least four at-home blood test companies that I can name off the top of my head that you don't even have to go to a doctor anymore. You could literally jump online, have a kit sent to your house. You could do the test yourself and send it back and have a 20-page report of all of these biomarkers. What are some of these background measures or words or names or things that we should be looking for as we're, you know, entering this new age of the consumer having really easy access to this data?
Yeah. So we actually know a lot about risk factors for both stroke risk as well as brain health. Good news is a lot of things are overlapping. So if you do certain things that are good for stroke risk prevention, it's also going to help maintain your brain health and prevent cognitive decline. So we actually know a lot. Blood pressure is one. So knowing that number and knowing whether or not you should be treated for high blood pressure is really important. And the recent guidelines that were published by the American Heart Association last year really make it clear that that previous sort of tolerance of elevated blood pressure is not really healthy for your body and certainly not healthy for your brain. And that means anybody above 120 over 80 millimeters of mercury. And so knowing that number, and that's just a blood pressure measurement that you can do at home, as you're pointing out, that you don't need to go to a doctor for that. Those kits for blood pressure measurement are available at most pharmacies. And you can start recording them and sharing them with your doctor and then deciding whether you're somebody who needs to either start on medications or do some other things to lower blood pressure before you need medications. Low salt, losing weight, those types of things can also have an effect. Another key metric that we know about is knowing your cholesterol. That's something that you can get on a blood test, right? And these are really simple. And if your cholesterol is elevated, you can, again, do a few things to change your lifestyle. And if that works, then you've achieved, hopefully, the goal of lowering cholesterol without medications. If it doesn't, there's a whole, you know, group and number of medications that are available that can be identified that work for an individual patient. Knowing your sugar level is another one. Now that's becoming popular with these little skin measurement tools that you can use. And knowing those numbers, again, you might be able to pick up somebody who is pre-diabetic. And pre-diabetes is no longer something that we just accept and tolerate, because we know damage is being done if you say, oh, it's just pre-diabetes, don't do anything about that, we can wait until you're diabetic. Well, the damage is being done while you're pre-diabetic too. So taking it seriously is really important. We know a lot about diet in general and what types of foods are healthy for you and what types of foods aren't. So the Mediterranean diet is one that we talk a lot about with patients that's having both stroke benefits and brain health benefits, dementia prevention benefits. And so lots of fish and foods that are high in non-saturated oils, white meat or healthy meats, if you're going to eat meat as opposed to red meat, things like nuts and fruits and vegetables as opposed to simple sugars and complex carbohydrates as well. So all of that is very much important lifestyle decisions. Sleep is an emerging one, and now you have apps for that too. Having a certain number of hours of sleep is really critical to your heart health, your brain health, and measuring that, tracking that, and treating conditions that could be causing you to have impaired or broken sleep is really important. So those are just a few ways people can take control of their life. Measuring blood pressure, measuring sugar, measuring cholesterol, measuring your weight, measuring your sleep quality, having a healthy diet, measuring physical activity. I didn't mention that. That's also an app and wearable. And getting a sense of how much physical activity are you getting in a regular day or week. All of those are numerically powerful ways to take control of your health.
What about the differences between men and women? You mentioned a lot of things to be conscious of in the background. Are there anything else that you would add to a list specific to either one of those groups?
I would say that, you know, definitely from a stroke perspective, we know there's differences in men and women. One of the main differences is that stroke risk increases during certain periods of a woman's life, including pregnancy, including once they are postmenopausal. And certainly there's controversy, but certain hormonal therapies can increase risk as well. So women are different by virtue of the hormonal contribution and periods of their life. In addition to that, women tend to live longer than men, but even independent of that, strokes seem to develop in older ages in women compared to men. For a variety of reasons, they seem to have more severe strokes, more related to AFib and larger strokes, and therefore sometimes worse outcomes are seen in women than in men. And finally, there's maybe even differences in the way a woman presents with stroke symptoms than a man. We think of classic symptoms or typical symptoms as being, you know, one side weakness and certain features that are very easy to detect in a stroke patient. Women may have more atypical symptoms. Maybe there's more confusion and generalized symptoms in a woman presenting with actual stroke compared to a man. So these make it challenging to diagnose, and sometimes it delays proven treatments in women.
When somebody starts to experience a stroke, right? I've never had a firsthand experience with somebody around me experiencing it. Can you paint a picture for me of what I would be experiencing, and then help me understand how to help that individual navigate those immediate moments?
Yeah, a stroke, as I mentioned briefly earlier, is when there's a blood flow disruption to the brain. And the blood flow disruption can be a blockage, which is called an ischemic stroke. Okay, that's a blocked blood flow. Cells are dying because not enough blood is getting through that blockage, and oxygen and nutrients are not getting to the cells that need it almost by second. The other type of stroke is called a hemorrhagic stroke, a bleeding stroke. And that's when the blood vessel bursts. It's no longer just blocked. It's not a blockage. It's a burst blood vessel, and blood is pouring into the brain, causing it to destroy tissue and put pressure on the tissue. Both lead to the similar symptoms of somebody who might be experiencing a stroke, to your question. They'll immediately notice something is wrong. So it's a sudden change in their neurologic function. We think about 80% of symptoms can be summarized by face, arm, and speech symptoms. That's why FAST is such an important mnemonic. F stands for facial drooping, A for arm weakness, and S for speech difficulty. And then the T is time to call 911. So it's FAST. So about 80% of stroke presentations will include one or all three of those symptoms. A face droop, arm is weak on one side, and they're having speech problems, whether it's slurred or they're mixing up words or they're not understanding words. The brain is, you know, quickly having cellular changes in the setting of a stroke. Within seconds, they're losing oxygen. Within minutes, they're starting to fail. And potentially within hours, it's irreversible. And so we want to make sure that that irreversible stage doesn't hit. And so identifying that a person is having symptoms of a stroke, using things that are very simple for the layperson, a face, arm, and speech assessment, looking at their face, does it look droopy on one side? Looking if you ask them to raise their arm, one arm drops and the other arm stays up, and also assessing their speech, is it slurred or they just seem confused in the way they're able to answer or speak. That should initiate a call to 911. The 911 call will get you to an appropriate stroke center in most parts of the world and in the U.S. for sure. And at that point, the doctors can assess whether it's a bleeding stroke or a non-bleeding stroke by using brain imaging, CAT scan, or MRI quickly. And then based on that, decide on blood thinners, if it's a blockage, or ways to stop the bleeding if it's a bleeding stroke. And that's a really key fork in the road early on.
So FAST is a great, easy acronym, right? So just to walk back, if I am with someone experiencing this, face, arm, speech, time, and 911 immediately. It's helpful because I think as you're talking, instinctively, I'm thinking I'm putting them in the car and driving them to the hospital right now.
Yeah. So it's a common instinct because you want to quickly, you know, do something. The worry about that, and I understand why that instinct is so powerful. You want to take charge and help your loved one. The problem with that is the stroke patient can worsen very quickly, and it can lead to a person who no longer can control their airway. And that's very dangerous because they could start to choke. They could have other complications early on that a medical professional would need to help with. And if you were in a car and that happened, you wouldn't be able to assist or prevent some complication like that from happening. And more practically, it's also true that when you have lights and sirens and an ambulance to pick up and drive, you're going to get to the destination quicker. When you try to do it on your own and there's traffic and all sorts of other things, you will not get there quickly. And lastly, when an ambulance not only assesses, evaluates, and treats, and then drives to the appropriate stroke facility, they are also calling ahead. They're alerting that hospital through a radio, typically to the nurses and the doctors at that hospital, that so-and-so is on their way with a suspected stroke. That readies the stroke team that is then going to meet your loved one at the emergency room doors, getting them into CAT scans and other things that will facilitate and speed up treatment. Whereas if you walked in or drove in and you go through triage and you're waiting in that line, time is ticking and you're not going to help that person by having done that.
That was a very elaborate and helpful answer for the T of FAST, right? Yeah. Like ultimately everything you just said is why the T is there. You have,
that's right.
You only have so much time.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you only have so much time. And if you think you're doing things faster than an ambulance, you'd be surprised at how all those little things will add up to delays that an ambulance would have been much better at.
We touched on AFib. You keep using that acronym. I know what it means because I have a family member that has it. For those that are listening, can you just explain what AFib is and then maybe connect it to the conversation we've been having so far?
Yes. So atrial fibrillation, AFib is what we often abbreviate it as, is an arrhythmia, an irregular heartbeat that some people develop. It's more common as you get older. And it can be silent. A lot of times you don't notice you have an irregular heartbeat. And in some people, a minority of people, they'll notice symptoms. They'll feel faint. They'll feel a palpitation, a regular sort of beating that they can feel on their chest. And some people, it'll be so much so that their lightheadedness might even cause them to faint. But in the vast majority of people, they don't know it. And only a EKG or a heart monitor will pick up that they're in this arrhythmia, this atrial fibrillation arrhythmia. And it has really important implications. And the reason why stroke neurologists care about it is it's probably the strongest single risk factor for stroke, even though it's not as common as high blood pressure, which is probably the most the largest fraction of stroke could be attributed to hypertension. AFib has the strongest direct effect of causing a stroke if not treated. And the reason for that is when the heart fibrillates, when the atrium and the atrial appendage fibrillates, it's not pumping regularly. And that pumping is really important for blood to keep moving. You've seen it when you cut your skin or you have a gash. Blood starts to coagulate, clot, pretty quickly. That's a normal, natural function of blood. And still blood tends to do that, while moving blood that's, you know, sort of in motion doesn't. So when a heart is fibrillating, it's quivering. It's not pumping and moving. And so when it's just quivering, there's stasis, no movement of blood in a particular region of the heart, and that'll lead to clot formation. And clot formation is really the way the heart then sends that clot, when it does kick into a regular beat, it kicks it out and it can go traveling in the arteries to the brain, blocking an artery, causing the stroke that we talked about, where initially the blood blockage causes cells to die. So knowing about AFib, and of course, if you have symptoms that are concerning, I said that's the minority, but it is something that, you know, if you have symptoms of lightheadedness or palpitations, going to a doctor to get a EKG or a heart monitor is really key. And in people who have neurologic symptoms like a stroke event or a TIA event, heart monitoring is really, really a standard thing we do, because we want to pick up AFib that was silent, that no one knew about. And when we pick it up and we know about it, anticoagulating them, blood thinners, is a really important way to prevent a stroke from happening.
That was going to be my next question, around, you know, if you are living with AFib, you know, it's common that you're going to pass through cycles of an AFib event for the rest of your life, right? Because none of us are perfect, and we're going to fall off our diet or whatever, right? And that was going to be my next question around, so what do you do in that instance when they're having an event? And you answered that with medication or...
Yeah, it's because of that chance of going in and out of AFib. That's why we think blood thinning is necessary, because we can't take the chance that, oh, you're not in AFib now, maybe you won't be in AFib ever again. But what when you do go into AFib, then the blood thinner prevents a clot from forming in that left atrium, top part of the heart. So I think it's really important to think about that, and important to emphasize that, oh, I don't feel like I'm in AFib. I know when I'm in AFib. That's maybe true for some people, and it is true that not everybody's in chronic AFib, persistent AFib. That term of paroxysmal or intermittent AFib, that is a common pattern. But because you don't know when you'll go into AFib, and because there's probably a chance that clots can form very quickly when you go into AFib, you can't just say, I won't be on a blood thinner, I'll just wait for AFib to happen. It may be too late.
Mm. For those that are on blood pressure medication, maybe they know that they just found out they're pre-diabetic, they have high cholesterol, or they go in and out of AFib like we've been discussing, or another one of my family members actually had a cardiac event, they have a device. Like these individuals, what type of conversation should they be having with their doctors if they're listening today and they've been inspired to be more proactive or active with themselves with regards to their journey?
Well, I think those with risk factors are a whole other category, you know, where they're doctors and they should be talking about their individual risk of stroke. And if they have AFib, you can calculate a score of stroke risk. It's called CHADS BAS score. And that's a combination of all their risk factors and their age, of course. And it gives you a sense of, are you high risk with AFib, or are you low risk with AFib, low in AFib? All you have is AFib, but you don't have other risk factors. But if you're high risk because you have a bunch of other risk factors, that's even, you know, an important stage to sort of say, I got to now really take these recommendations from doctors around risk factor management, but also blood thinner management really seriously.
And that was Chad C.
Chad's Bask. C-H-A-D S-V-A-S-C.
Chad's Bask. I want to spin the conversation a little bit just to land this airplane. We talked a lot around, I think a lot in the weeds around strokes and understanding what goes into these events. I want to pivot a bit and talk a little bit more around the aftermath or the implications of, okay, I had a stroke. You know, that's a massive life event. What happens next, right? And that's the type of conversation I want to get into now. And I imagine when you are treating patients or you're working with patients, one of the first things that comes on the table for them is this loss of independence and their identity. In my opinion, it's definitely an identity shifting moment for them.
It is.
How do you help them navigate that?
Yeah, well, I think it's very much important to sort of set the tone that this is now a lifelong journey. Yes, we're trying to do things very early to reverse that injury and make it the smallest possible, meaning those changes that are happening in the brain in the minutes, we can reverse some of it if we give them a blood thinner or a device to take a clot out, early hospital management. All of that's really important. But those that are left with disability, which is still a significant percentage of stroke patients, the majority actually will be left with some disability, even with all the best treatments we have early. Those patients have to kind of now acknowledge that they're on a journey. They're on a journey. And that journey is slow, but it can be very hopeful because of some of the things you mentioned earlier on, that actually there are lots of things we can do to restore function. It starts with early access to rehabilitation. Those are your physical therapists, your speech therapists, your occupational therapists, going to those sessions, whether that's right after the hospitalization in another hospital called a rehab hospital, or doing it at home in the first few weeks to months. That's really critical. That period of time after a stroke where your brain is what we now know rewiring, where it's not regrowing. We don't think a large percentage of recovery is not from regrowth. It's from rewiring. And we call that neuroplasticity. That means that it's flexible, it's bendable. The brain has abilities to compensate and recover through reestablishing connections through uninjured brain areas. And how do we facilitate or catalyze that? We do that by stimulating those parts of the brain. And stimulating those parts of the brain involves physically stimulating it through exercise, cognitively stimulating it through socialization, interactions, language stimulation through conversations and reading. And all of those things are really, really now part of how we talk about recovery. If you do these things, physical therapy, speech therapy, socialization, cognitive interactions and stimulation, these things will likely give you the best chance of getting the most recovery from your stroke. To your other point, which is how do you really set this all up? It's a team effort. Not only do you need all these individuals from the healthcare system, therapists and rehab doctors and neurologists, but you also need a team at your home and in your community, right? A caregiver is going to be a big part of that team. It could be a spouse. It could be children. It could be a friend. And these individuals are a lifeline because they're helping the stroke patient adjust, right? They have to first adjust to life without a function that they were so used to. And that might mean they need assistance with certain activities, certain tasks in the home, getting around, their community. That's going to be the caregiver's principal job. And we have to be sensitive to the caregiver burden in stroke because that's sometimes missed. We don't often understand what the caregiver is going through from a stress perspective, from a overall physical and emotional demand that individual or individuals may be feeling. We want to kind of emphasize that there's a lot of opportunity for improvement and keep people positive for as long as possible around continuing to push for changes that they can, you know, hopefully measure over time that you're seeing some improvement. We want to recognize and treat depression, which is not uncommon in this situation for the reasons we've talked about, but also for brain reasons, for chemical reasons. So not to stigmatize that, but actually identify it, recognize it, and then treat it. That's really important as well. So those are all the ways I think about it, is it's a team effort. There are definitely times when a stroke patient's journey is really challenging. They're really struggling, and we have to support them, and we have to hopefully give them hopeful messages about the ways that they can still gain quality of life and dignity, and hopefully the kind of living that gives them some joy and happiness.
I love that, because it adds a lot of color to the journey that we talked about on this podcast for the last 30 minutes leading up to that moment where you just shared, which was a lot of the medicine and the doctor and the hospital. And that stuff is great, but I think a lot of the success of the medical treatment side, it has to do with its integration with all the things you just mentioned.
Absolutely. We're, you know, doctors and healthcare professionals, we're a small part of a human being's, a patient's life. We see them intermittently. We see them maybe a lot when they're hospitalized, but we see them intermittently. Percentage-wise, that's a small percentage of everybody's life and everybody's day. Many more people, many more events are happening outside of that healthcare environment and healthcare interaction. Those are really important, and they probably have been underemphasized by the healthcare community. And I think we need to make sure that those systems outside of healthcare really support the patient.
What are you most hopeful about right now, and specifically in your lane of medicine?
Well, there's a lot of great things. Again, I think that advances are happening at a pace that we've never seen before. We really see that in our practice now. Clinical trials are being published at a pace we haven't seen before, with really cool results and paradigm shifts, things that we didn't think were possible. We are now at an age where I think AI and what we call brain-computer interface, kind of the ability to implant chips that can connect to the brain cells and wiring and restore certain functions. That's actually being tested in humans now.
Wow.
That is, you know, something out of sci-fi from, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we thought about that as Terminator and these sorts of movies where we said, oh, maybe that'll happen one day. Well, it is happening. And that has the real powerful potential because, think about what I said earlier, the brain's cells don't regrow. Well, how can we restore function if you lose, you know, a significant volume of brain tissue? Well, one way is to interface that with computer chips that actually compensate and actually do the work of the cells that died. And we're beginning to see the first evidence of that in humans. And I would say in the next 10 to 20 years, you're going to see that actually become some form of standard practice. Maybe not all home runs. Certainly, that's our experience with anything. We don't get home runs right away, but we get better and better with these technologies over time. So I think that's really exciting. There's new drugs that even this week, there's a new trial that found a new type of blood thinner that prevents more strokes in people who need a blood thinner. So we're just going to keep seeing the advances in medicine and science take off at a pace that, you know, we haven't seen ever before.
Last question. This one's for the listener. It's Heart Month. If you could give one call to action for anyone listening to this, whether you're clean bill of health or you've experienced some of the things we've discussed, what would that be?
Well, I think the message is somewhat summarizing what I said earlier. If you can know your blood pressure and control it if it's high, detect AFib if you feel it or you have a reason to go for an EKG or monitor, and try to live a heart and brain healthy lifestyle, sleep better, eat well, be physically active, socially engaged, you can actually prevent a lot of strokes. About 80% of all strokes can be prevented, and you can prevent cognitive decline decades later.
Love that. Any final words?
No, I just want to kind of thank you all for listening. Stroke is something I care a lot about. I think you've shed a lot of light onto why that is important and should be important for people. It's a leading cause of disability and, of course, still a leading cause of death. And so we want people to prevent it in the first place and hopefully, again, get in quickly. If you are going to have a stroke, get in quickly so that these things that we talked about can reduce the damage and get you back to functioning at the highest level.
Love it. Dr. Prabhakaran, thank you so much for our conversation today. I learned a ton. For anyone listening, if you want to learn more around stroke or many other kinds of conditions, please visit theeducatedpatient.com and stay tuned for many more episodes coming up in 2026. Have a great day, everyone.